Half Hour with me, Rick Kogan. That is the title track off a brand new fantastic CD, George the Bomb, and it is my honor to have in here that very George Freeman, who on April 10th celebrated his 92nd birthday, but also at the same time, George, very few 92-year-olds, or a guy who used to do it, is Studs Terkel, when he was in his 90s, went, well, Rick, I'm 93 and I'm celebrating a new book. You are celebrating the CD, too. Howard Reich wrote a couple fantastic pieces about you in the Tribune. I've been talking to you out here. What's the secret, George? What's the secret to remaining vibrant and alive and creative? Because this CD, done by the other guests in the studio, Joni Pilato and Bradley Parker Sparrow, husband and wife, a musical team, and dear friends of mine. What's the secret, George?
People like Joni Sparrow and you.
Yeah.
Keep you going because you're so beautiful, you know, so alive. Because when you're coming up, you meet people that just don't like you.
True words were never spoken. And one of the things, though, about George and Joni and Sparrow get into this, coming up, you and your late brother, Von Freeman, who I just adored, not as much as you did, but I adored him. You guys when you were coming up, I mean, it is a list of jazz history. It is Charlie Parker, it's Stan Getz, it's Sonny Stitt, it's Johnny Griffin, it's Ben Webster, and 1,000 other names. Mm. Did they not treat you well when you were young?
Beautiful. Beautiful.
They did.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's a funny thing. All the professionals always did treat you wonderfully. It's those that are not professional, they treat you bad.
Right, because, well, in many ways, because they're jealous, I think, part of it.
Well, I don't know what it is, but I know there's a difference. It's a difference in the good and the bad.
Yeah.
And seeing like all the professionals, they have such a hard life themselves.
Sure.
And they know what it is to come out here and see somebody trying to make it. Well, scuffle like they did, you know.
Well, and it's a hard life to devote yourself, as you and your brother did, to music. I mean, music, and Joni, and you and Sparrow know this, too. I mean, that is a sacrifice. It's not like getting a job as an accountant or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's quite different.
But on the other hand, you get all the pleasure and all the joy of creating this beautiful music and art, so...
Well, and all the rewards, too. There've got to be. You were at the Green Mill a couple nights ago for the annual birthday party that Dave Gemmelo said is going to go on forever. He goes, well, I can't wait till he's back when he's 100.
But Gemmelo did say that.
He did. Mm-hmm. What is it like for the three of you? And I want you two to talk about this, too.
I think it's fantastic, really.
But seeing, you must get some kind of amazing kind of energy from your interaction playing the guitar and the audience, they must, just in the way they react to you, not just screaming and applauding, but a vibe that is shared.
Well, you know, Rick, I'd tell you the truth about me is that the audience is one thing, and personally, the way you feel is another thing, though. But, you know, I was raised with a religious family.
Mm-hmm.
My mother and the background and see, when I was coming up, I was the teacher's pet.
I can understand that. I can see why that is.
I'm not through yet.
No, you're never. You won't be through.
I was the teacher's pet. Yeah. When I was going to church, I didn't want to make me the altar boy.
Mm-hmm.
This is
news to me.
when my mother kept me in the house because I was just nice and quiet. Until I got to be
before you were George the Bomb?
Oh, this is long before George the Bomb.
this was the first CD was George the Altar Boy.
Yeah.
The first CD was George the Altar Boy.
George, you want to make me the altar boy, yeah.
When did you take me back? When did you first touch a guitar?
Well, my brother played a ukulele. Oldest brother was.
Yeah.
He wanted to charm the ladies. So he would go around playing ukulele, singing to the ladies in the neighborhood.
Did it work?
It worked for him. It sure did. And then what happened to me was I at a nightclub there called the Rum Boogie Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a guitar player in there playing. His name was T-Bone Walker.
Oh, wow, sure.
And I used to go around there in the back door and look inside the door there. My daddy would kill me if he knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
And I watched him play the guitar. He played the guitar with the guitar behind his neck.
Yeah, yeah.
Singing, "You Call This Stormy Monday." And so I went home, and the women were throwing money at him and all that stuff. You know, I was impressed. But my oldest brother, Buzz, see, my father used to come, he was a policeman. And my mother was super religious, bless her heart. If you talked to my mother and you mentioned God, you was in. I really, you're talking about God,
yeah,
from my mother.
Sure.
Oh, I love you. You're just so nice. Come on in. And my father used to bring home different musicians from different parts. He worked, he had a beat on 35th Street at the Grand Terrace. Mm. And he bring different people over to the house, like
Earl
Hines.
Didn't your father bring Louis Armstrong to the house?
Yeah, Louis Armstrong to the house. It's just a wonderful thing. And then we had a radio. And at that time, they had jazz bands coming on the radio.
Sure. Sure.
And I used to listen to the radio day in, day out. So finally what happened was I went to this, I heard this guitar player playing, and my oldest brother, Bruz, would bring home all the latest current records. And he brought on this Benny Goodman record with Charlie Christian.
Wow. Sure.
Now, sure. I've always been enthusiastic about the saxophone, because my brother plays saxophone.
Yes, he did.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
So therefore, when I was... Vaughn would play the horn and go in the closet and practice and close the door. And so I was the altar boy, you know.
Yeah, I know. You were the teacher's pet.
Don't forget
that.
I was the altar boy. So my father, when he get mad at me and my mother, they put me in the closet.
With a guitar or all by yourself?
By myself in the closet.
Wow.
Put me in there with all those sacks of clothes in the closet.
Sure, sure.
So I go in there and go
to... Go to sleep?
I'll be glad to get in there. I'll go in there and go to sleep. On top, so Vaughn one day, he said, listen. He said, you got to stop just carrying on what you're doing. I don't know what I was doing. I was the altar boy. I didn't know what I was doing. So he says, you got to stop going to the closet. I go in there and practice all the time.
You know? He wanted the space for himself to practice.
Yeah, he didn't have any other closet to practice in.
Only one closet.
He said, now stop sleeping there and get out.
Yeah, it did. That's what he did. Say, so you got to stop this. You got to get your act together. He talked to me like he's my father.
Sure.
You got to get your act together and cut that out. And I got to go in there and practice my horn.
Wow.
So every time they go to come in the closet and get me, I'll be in there asleep.
So did you ever think about practicing in the closet?
Did you practice your guitar?
I wasn't playing the guitar at the time.
Oh, okay.
All right, we got to take a break, but we'll be back with George Freeman, Joni Pilato, and Bradley Parker Sparrow. We're talking about, there's a party coming up Friday, another event, another of the endless birthday parties for George Freeman, who has turned 92 on April 10th. And his lovely mother, who he was just talking about, lived to be 103. So listen to this man, ladies and gentlemen. He has the secret to longevity and creativity. Another tune from the brand new CD release. I love talking about CD releases because so many people just stream junk, and they don't even understand what CDs are anymore. But that is from George the Bomb, brought to you by Southport Records, run by Bradley Parker Sparrow and his beautiful singing wife. Sparrow and I have collaborated on a couple of musical spoken word feats, which was great fun for me, Sparrow. We really should do that again sometime. Really should. But you were just, there's another CD release party this Friday. all the information, and especially the information about how to buy George Freeman's latest CD, George the Bomb. They don't have available the George the Altar Boy or George the Teacher's Pet or the George Who Lives in the Closet CDs, but those are coming. How did this CD come to be? Joni, you just said that George kind of composed that while you guys were recording.
Well, some of the songs we had discussed a lot in our many phone conversations, talking about what we should record to include on the record with Billy Branch, with just the band, a couple of things George wanted me to sing.
With you.
He wanted Sparrow to play on Tonto. But Uncle Funky, I said, George, we need another song. We don't have enough songs for the record. I said, didn't you say something about your nephew Mark calls you Uncle Funky? I said, can't you write an Uncle Funky song? And right then and there, he just wrote it.
Were you two, you know, not being a musician, I'm amazed at almost everything musicians do, but were you, Sparrow, particularly amazed at that ability?
Yeah, that's very rare.
Myself
as a pianist and a composer, sometimes you'll labor over an idea for weeks, or you throw it in the garbage. And George said, "Yeah, I got this riff here," and show it to the bass player and the drummer, and all of a sudden, improvisation, the mutual respect of all the musicians sharing.
Yeah,
you get a song that
that works. It's like creating something out of. You know, it's like Michelangelo sculpting something or a painter painting something.
So
what is
song,
it like?
If I can say, the song is so new. And George, I hope you don't mind if I tell the little story last night, right before the third set.
Yeah.
George comes up to me and he's like, Joni. I said, what? He said, how does Uncle Funky go?
It was an inspiration. It came like that. George, I know you have a deep affection for Chicago, but man, you and your late brother Vaughn saw the music scene change like crazy over the decades.
It certainly
and I
is.
Know you've been all over the world. What is it that keeps you and your music so, you know, tied to Chicago?
But you wouldn't believe this, though, but I have to say it. God speaks to me. He tells me exactly what to do.
Yeah.
I heard people say before, I got to feel it. I got to do this. I got to do that. And I got to do this and do that and do this and do that. Well, with me, it seemed like we worked last night, and with different personalities all together. The drummer. He don't know what you're going to do. Organ player is on the other end.
Yeah.
And a guitar player, thank God he's sitting next to me. He used to stand up and play. Jonas told me to tell him to sit down.
Well, you're connecting better that way, because you sit down now.
I stand up playing the guitar when I was coming up. Guitar dead up in the air.
Sure. Like a minute man with a guitar.
right.
But that's no more. So when you're playing the music now, it's just the ideas when I be playing. He tells me what to play, how to play. Because up there, you don't know what you're going to do. People out there.
But that's what, you know, I remember my father would play me as a very young man, these old, you know, 48s or whatever they were called, 78s of Louis Armstrong, who he adored and who he saw here. And so I was imbued with jazz from my earliest age. And that's one of the great things about watching jazz. You could say, okay, we're going to do like cut three off our new CD, and it's never going to be the same on any stage because there's a language that goes on, isn't
Absolutely.
There? Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. No doubt about that, you know. So
that's the beauty of improvisation. So even if it's a composition like Uncle Funky,
right,
it's going to be different.
But there's a freedom to go. I think it's a matter. That's what jazz is. It's a freedom to go other places and take other routes and maybe come back to the song or maybe not come back to the song.
Well, that's the point there, Rick. Now, you've got to be free to do what you want to do.
Yes.
Now, Joni made a point, made a statement in the car. Now, the drummer and I don't see each other until next year at this time. So when he comes on stage, you don't know what you're going to do.
Yeah, but there's also such excitement in that, isn't there, George?
Certainly it is.
There's danger. There's a little risk involved, I think.
There's always a risk involved in playing. We don't know who you're playing with.
Yeah, right, right. How many CDs do you have?
Joni? Well, recordings?
Yeah.
Well, four with Southport. We did Rebellion was your first CD we did together, and that's one where Vaughn Freeman said, oh, it's George's turn. You guys have to record George. I want you to record George. And I said, Vaughn, I've told this story before. Vaughn, who's going to play piano on the record? And Vaughn said, I am. Mm-hmm. So it's one of, I think, the very few instances where Vaughn is playing piano on a recording, you know, and he was wonderful.
Yeah,
the pianist, oh my God. Well, a great musician. So.
Fantastic. And all of this, you should really go to chicagosound.com to get more information about how to buy
these
CDs and go to the party this coming Friday at.
Friday the 26th.
Oh, Friday the 26th. Yeah. Oh, we've got time to rest
up.
We've
got almost 2 weeks rest up.
Ricky, it's going to be out of sight.
You're excited about
this. What I'm going to do is just sign autographs, just sign pictures.
He's going to meet and greet at the bar and
oh my God, that
sign autographs.
So exciting.
We've got John Devlin doing live music. We're going to be playing George the Bomb CD all night. There's going to be George the Bomb drink specials, cornbread, and you name it. And it's at Lang's Lounge.
3500 North Southport.
3500 Southport from 6 to 9, Friday the 26th of
and you'll
April.
Have, you think you'll have enough CDs there? For people to buy?
They have to buy the CD if they're going to get some cornbread.
Okay. That sounds like
and the cornbread, the cornbread point is that Billy and George improvised a song on the CD called Where's the Cornbread? And it's a hit.
Well, we'll play that after the news. I'm going to keep you guys for a little while longer. But do, indeed, for all the information about this party at Lang's Lounge, which is a week from this coming Friday, and information about George Freeman's CDs and all the, I'm the official biographer of Southport Records. What number are we up to now? How many?
Oh, yeah.
How many?
This is 148.
That makes them a Chicago treasure, don't you think, George? Because they're very, you know, a record label, continually putting out music from Chicago treasure.
I can't believe it myself, really.
Yeah, I know. It's just.
I can't believe it myself, really.
It is an amazing thing.
Fantastic.
Yep. We're going to get some news, and then we'll be back, and we'll listen to this cornbread song. Right, hand long? No, we will. I want to hear the cornbread song. What I really want to hear is the George altar boy song, or the George in a closet song, but we'll get to those.
Yeah, I was the altar boy, you know.
I know, man. I want
to hear. Also, I was the teacher's pet.
The teacher's pet. There's a three CD set. George the teacher's pet, George the altar boy, and George in the closet. Very difficult to find, but look at the Southport label coming up in the future.
I smell some cornbread.
Have to, ladies and gentlemen, buy the CD too. I would like to play as much as I can, but I'd much rather like talking to George Freeman, Bradley Parker, Sparrow, and Joni Pilato. Joni and Sparrow, the two who run the amazing treasure that is Southport Records and have put out their most recent release, their
148.
I keep tabs every couple of years. I write a long story about Southport being the greatest jazz music treasure in Chicago, 148. there's going to be a what sounds like a fabulous party a week from Friday, on Friday the 26th from 6. And if George Freeman says it's going to be a good party, oh, yeah, it's going to be a good party.
I'm looking forward to it.
It is a meet and greet. There, you're going to hear that CD. You're going to hear live music from John Devlin, and you're going to get cornbread. But yeah, mostly you're going to get to you're going to get to talk to George Freeman, because one of the he has a living history of jazz. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else to say it. Mm-hmm. He is a living history of jazz. I mean, you played with, and I think you once bought a drink for Charlie Parker, and it doesn't get
more. Oh, my goodness.
What was he like? Was he was
it's a great experience for me, because I remember coming up, my father brought the first Charlie Parker record into the house.
Wow.
When Vaughn and I never forget that. He'd come home with this record, and it was Charlie Parker playing saxophone on there. And I never thought I would end up playing with Charlie Parker. Mm. It was I couldn't even imagine it.
Well, it would be like a little league kid seeing Babe Ruth play.
And same thing.
Yeah, and say, well, I like baseball, but I'm never going to be with this guy. Right. It must have been amazing.
And on top of that, he fell in love with me.
Because you mentioned God to him, or wait a minute.
Well, I mean, he liked my plan, of course.
Well, you're halfway there.
He just fell in love with my plan, my ability to play his kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
And he was strictly a bebopper.
Yo, absolutely. Absolutely.
And I remember going to the bathroom in the back of the Persian ballroom. And I was late coming on the bandstand. It was time for the band to hit. And they were all gathered around Charlie Parker. And Burry said, "We don't start till George get here."
Oh, come on. Wow. Wow.
I heard him say it.
Wow. What a story. You liked him. You didn't just admire him, but you liked him.
Oh, God, yeah. He was God as far as the music was concerned.
Yeah.
Because when bebop came out there, I was just at the right time hearing it.
It sounds a lot too like, George, that your dad, the Chicago police officer, encouraged you and your brother.
Oh,
I mean, it was not like go be a dentist or something. It was like, listen to this music.
Mm. My father told me, he said, stick with track. I used to run track.
Yeah.
He told me, stick with the track. I told him I wanted to be a musician.
Well, you said, Dad, but there's no money in running track. That's not like a job.
No, what he meant by that, he wanted me to be clean.
Yeah.
And keep my physical being up. He didn't want me out there being a musician. So, therefore.
Because musicians are in smoky nightclubs.
Oh, and God.
People who run track are out in the daylight and the sunshine. But did he? He must have. Your folks must have been incredibly proud of you and Vaughn.
Well, like I said, it was three of us. Vaughn, Brush played drums. He was an excellent drummer.
Huh.
He was and Vaughn, saxophone player, and myself. And at one time, we all played together.
Oh, that must have been unbelievable.
It was the highlight of my life.
Oh,
you know?
I'll bet.
It was just simply fantastic, the three brothers playing together.
Oh.
And but I knew then that Vaughn told me way back, he said, take care of yourself. He said, because success has come to you late in life.
Mm.
I don't know what he meant by that, but I'm 92 now.
Well, you got some time. You can wait. Well, you can wait. I mean, Dave Jemelos. Hey, you know.
Rick, I don't know.
Yeah, you turned 92 on April 10th, and you seem, and I'm not being idiotic about this. You're as lively as anybody who's ever been. Dan will tell you this, too. As anybody who's ever been in this studio, and livelier than most. Yeah, there's no doubt about it.
Dan, is he telling the truth?
Who?
I think
absolutely,
George is turning back the clock, Rick. Right. He's getting younger.
Well, age is there's a chronological age, but there's also a creative age, I think. And I think part of it, George, you're playing with people like Billy and being with Joni and Sparrow.
That's what it is.
It is.
That's really the bottom line, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Keep going. Keep fresh ideas. Keep going. Because I imagine what would it be for Charlie Parker to be here now. What would he be doing?
Oh, boy.
Wow.
He'd be in his 90s, certainly in his...
Dizzy Gillespie.
Yeah.
Louis Armstrong, think about what he'd be doing. Yeah.
Well, Louis Armstrong would be wildly rich now. Maybe the great thing, Louis Armstrong could be president of the United States now if he lived.
If I didn't pull it, I mean, he put Ronald Reagan in there. He should have.
Well, he had a taste of politics, Oh, George, you're excited about this, not only this CD, but this party. I know you were ever excited to play and be on stage and collaborate with other musicians, but this meet and greet thing just sounds fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, when you go a week from Friday to 3500 North Southport to Lang's Lounge, because we won't be able to get to it today, I need you to ask George to what he was like as a Boy Scout. We've heard about him as an altar boy. We heard about him being locked in closets. This has been a wonderfully wide-ranging conversation. We've heard about him playing with Charlie Parker, and Charlie Parker holding the show up so George could come up on stage.
He sure did.
I know. So, what else could we hear? Well, there's a boy, George,
he
like
sure
as
did.
I, we're not of the same,
it
quite
came out
the same.
Of his mouth.
Huh? I know it did. Oh, I'm
like, George, to George, get here.
See, this is a guy, George. You are a human being that everything that comes out of your mouth, I believe. And
that's
that I certainly not say that about 99% of the people I know. I mean, there is no artifice to you. There's no artifice to the way you play.
Can't believe it.
There's no artifice to the way you perform. And that's why it is, Joni and Sperry. It has got to be you can obviously see how joyful I am, but it's got to be an ongoing joy for you to know this man.
Listen, Ricky, on top of that. At the Jazz Showcase, Joe Siegel's Jazz Showcase, it's a big picture up there of Charlie Parker.
Oh, yeah, I know, sure.
He got my town.
Yeah.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, next time you go to Jazz Showcase, look at Bird's tie, and that is George Freeman's tie.
Did he keep the tie, Charlie Parker?
Well, Vaughn gave it to him, you said.
Vaughn had the tie on.
Yeah.
But it was your tie.
And Bird walks in with no tie on and a white shirt. And Vaughn said, "Bird, you can't go out there looking like that." And Bird said, "Why?" He said, "You come, you don't have no tie on." He said, "What you want me to do?" Vaughn took off my tie that I gave to him to wear.
And gave it to Charlie Parker.
And put it around Bird's neck, and Bird put the tie on.
Wow.
And went back, left Chicago, went to New York City, and made that picture you saw with my tie.
So, ladies and gentlemen, the meet and greet with George Freeman a week from Friday at Lang's Lounge at 3500 North Southport, you have gotten simply a small taste of the depth and humanity and fun of this human being. You know what I think your next CD should be, George?
What?
I think it should just be storytelling. I think it should be cut one. Yeah. Boy Scout. Cut two, closet.
No,
cut three, Bird's tie.
It might have been too hard for storytelling. I couldn't stand it.
Really? I think you're pretty good at it. I got to tell you, George.
Only with you, Rick.
I cannot thank you three people for coming in here. That's and I right. cannot thank the three of you for continuing to do what you do to make music and to promote music.
Well,
and
thank you too, Rick.
And to give music to Chicago. Thank you. We got to take a little break. They're going to go home, and I'm going to keep rambling. That again, ladies and gentlemen, is a little more of George Freeman, greatest guitarist in Chicago. When my friend Tony Fitzpatrick, who's been on this show a number of times, the artist, actor, activist, bon vivant, everything else in the world, tells me he has a new favorite artist, I listen. Tony and I have known each other for, pushing 40 difficult years. But he tells me, he says, Rick, we're having an incredible show by an artist named Patty Kirk, and he sent me some of her work, and Patty Kirk joins me on the phone. Patty, Tony is a very persuasive guy, but I love what he showed me of, you know how persuasive he is. This is the first show you're in your early 60s, and this is your first art exhibition, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, my first solo art exhibition.
Well, the ever convincing Tony Fitzpatrick. Patty, tell me. Tony's told me a bit about you, and I'm going to read a little stuff of what he's said about you. But you tell me about yourself.
Okay, I grew up in Lombard with my mom and dad, and I had eight brothers and sisters, so there were nine kids. And that's how I met Tony, because we went to the same Catholic school. He was younger than me, but we were at the same Catholic school, so I didn't really know him, but my brother and sister knew him.
Well, the way Tony talks about his Catholic school childhood, it's like he couldn't have been there. He had a problem with that kind of authority, is what he always says. But he, as we both know, he's a good kid. What did you know about your brother and sister knew him, and you just had heard about the legend of Tony Fitzpatrick, right?
Well, I didn't really know he was an artist until I saw him at Otto's. It was a little bar in Lombard.
Sure.
And, you know, we were in our 20s then, and he was at the bar drawing, is how I remember it. And then just through the years, so that was in the late 70s. And so through the years, I would see, I remember going to a gallery in the 80s, Carl Hammer.
Yeah,
and I remember seeing some of his work at some of the galleries when I was around. And this was probably in maybe 89, 90.
Were you an artist, Patty Kirk? Were you an artist then, too?
Yeah, I have a BFA in art, so I did, you know, I always did drawing and painting, especially after college. I started concentrating on painting, and then I had kids, three kids.
That will drag you away from the easel, raising three kids.
Yeah, and I worked retail. You know, I worked nights so I could stay home with the kids and do art on the side, painted furniture, just kind of did what fit into my lifestyle, you know, as a mom and
Did the type
of paint I was using. I would, you know, I wouldn't use oils because it smelled up the house, and I had little kids running around. So I just kind of painted so it fit into my life.
Yeah. Were you painting with any kind of, you know, sort of commercial aim, or it was just you were expressing an artistic passion without any specific kind of goal?
Yeah, no art, no commercial. I mean, I really am not business minded, which is why it's taken me so long to have a show.
I
needed a lot of help and encouragement to have a show because, I don't know, I'd been out it for so long and I never really was a driven artist.
Yeah.
I just did it because I loved it. I loved painting.
You know, one of the things, Patty Kirk, I think that's basically the way Tony started, you know, when he was, you know, if you knew him in the 70s, he was probably still having a cocktail or two in those days. And he didn't really get commercially minded till he stopped drinking. But I see your point. I know what you're talking about. It just, you know, if you're expressing your own passion, you do take some arm twist. It does take some arm twisting to make it, you know, public and to make it commercial and to have your own show. I'm assuming, I know you have a show up now at the Dime that opened last week called A Month of Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
And the Dime is Tony and Max's great, intimate art gallery at 1513 Northwestern. How did I get the sense that you'd been part of group shows before?
Well, I had a couple shows, you know, before I got my BFA when I was in my
20s. Long time ago, yeah.
Yeah, and then I didn't do anything. And then I guess about maybe 15 years ago, I started painting on furniture because it also fit my lifestyle. I'm a junker, so I'd find stuff in the garbage and drag it home and paint furniture, and I would enter my furniture in, like, craft and art shows.
Sure,
you know, so
sure.
I did become an Illinois artisan doing that, but that was through painting furniture, and I didn't really like doing that anymore because it just took a long time, and it was painting a 3D piece. So I just kind of lightly kept painting through the years. And I don't know, the way Tony found me is he kind kind of kept in touch with my family, and really through Facebook, I would see his work and comment on it, and then I would post things, and he'd comment on it, and that connection started about 10 years ago, I guess.
Well, I'm sure he is. Tony is one of the great talkers I've ever met in my life. So it's not as if he's going to keep his feelings secret from you. But this is what he wrote me in a note, and we had talked about you for some time on the phone, but he wrote... in an introduction to your show, and the show is up at the Dime Gallery, currently up there, 1513 Northwestern Avenue, he wrote this: Patty Kirk's paintings speak to her strong Catholic faith and spirituality, her adherence to the primacy of family and faith. They also invoke thoughts of that which is unseen, a pursuit of the invisible. An invocation to the spirits, which are a foundational element of her faith. She's been painting. Now he tells me stuff that I already know here. Please join us. He calls your work, Patty, mysterious, marvelous, and powerful. And I will echo those sentiments. I'm looking at a picture of a lady with a dog. That is, the dog is as big as the lady. It's one of the most stunning pieces. I've got to come up there. Is that up at the show?
Yeah, it's up. I have 18 pieces up. So, yeah, that one's up.
Was it hard? What did Tony finally do to convince you? I mean, you seem like such a lovely person and self-effacing, and all of a sudden Tony's like, you got to have a show. I got to put you up at the Dime. You got to put you up at the Dime. Was it hard to convince you?
It did take him a lot because I wasn't very forward calling him, and I was kind of shy, and I didn't really know how the art world works.
Honestly, Pat, that's probably for the best, because the way Tony, the whole gallery scene there, Tony will tell you, it's a very politicized world, and I think this, your entry into it could not be at a better place than the Dime. When you picked out the 18 pieces you were going to exhibit, and you obviously, worked with Tony and Max about where they were going to be hung. But when you walked into that opening of your show and saw them all on the walls, what do you think?
Well, it was just, I was so nervous. And since January, since I knew when it was going to be, it's just been this buildup. And not just with me, but my whole family, because, I'm 62, so my whole family's been going through my art career with me.
Yeah.
My mom and dad are 89, and it was such a big night for all of us, and I've been sitting in my studio for a long time painting, and it's kind of like singing a song that a lot of people don't get to hear, don't know how people feel about it. Sometimes I don't know if they're bad or really good or really bad, it's just
sure.
So
well, it's being, that's very interesting, because I'm sure the opening night gathering was filled with a lot of your relatives and friends.
Yeah.
And they're likely to be an easy crowd, but it also would attract that Tony Fitzpatrick Dime and Tony and Max Dime crowd, and all of a sudden it's like having to stand up in class when you're
exactly.
when you're in fourth grade, and you're like, well, I don't really want to do this. But Tony tells me, he says that many pieces have sold, not to family members. Has it inspired you? Has it energized you? Has it empowered you?
I've been empowered for the last, I would say, year.
Yeah.
Since Tony said, I want you to have a show.
Mm-hmm.
Because I went to a book signing of his at Fitzgerald's.
Those are always crazy.
And that was the first time he said, I want you to have a show. It was my 60th birthday.
Oh.
And after that, I looked at my painting different, because when Tony said it to me, I was like, well, maybe I do need to have a show. Maybe I should do this. Maybe I can do this. So it hasn't changed since the show. It's probably been 2 years, and I've looked at painting so different.
Sure.
It's like I'm more excited about it. and more confident.
See, I think that's a big thing too. I get it, but you're like a flower blooming now. You know what I mean? And it's very hard to pause and say, yeah, I feel exactly this way about it. It's an organic thing, the way you're feeling, and it's all of it absolutely, absolutely justified. With you, in the couple minutes we have left, Patty, and it's a real pleasure to meet you even on the phone and see your work. How do you describe, Tony's one thing, Tony has his particular viewpoint, but how do you describe, if we were on a bus and I sat down and I said, hey, how are you? And we both said, God, it's snowing in April, that's crazy. And if I said to you, you said, what do you do? I said, I write for a newspaper. And I said to you, what do you do? And you said, I'm an artist. And I said, what are your paintings like? What would you say?
Well, they're just, I used to only paint pretty things, but now I just paint things that make me feel something. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, 10 years ago, I was always looking for something that I thought was beautiful.
Yeah.
But now I think what I think is beautiful has changed totally, and I just look for something, I don't know, I'm always collecting things and looking at images and...
Well, something that moves you, something that strikes a spark in you.
Yes.
You know, and I do love Tony's description, mysterious, marvelous, and powerful. That covers a lot of ground. Patty Kirk is on exhibit at the Dime Gallery, probably through the end of the month. The Dime is at 1513... Northwestern Avenue. You can go to Facebook, Dime Gallery, and see a work of Patty's and figure out what hours they are. And then you can go say hi to Max and Tony, who are often there, and Patty, if she drops by. Patty, it's a real pleasure to meet you over the phone.
Thank you so much.
We have a great mutual friend in Tony, and you are a great artist. So
Thank you, Rick.
Well, no, if someone says, well, what kind of paintings do you paint? Say, well, Rick Hogan thinks they're great. So it's the easy answer. It's really a treat to talk to you, sweetie. And I can't wait to see your work in person. I can't wait.
I'll let you
know exactly what I think, too. Patty Kirk, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, take care. Take care. What a nice person. We'll be talking about old movies for a little while after the 10 o'clock news, and then we will be talking about jazz again with Chris Green. Some time ago, I had in, I don't know if it was this studio or the old studio, these nice everybody's young to me, young people from the Chicago Film Society who were telling me then about this. Oh, Rick, we've got a old film here about the Chicago Daily News, which was very, very close to my heart at the time. And they said, when we finish restoring it, you'll be one of the first to see it. I've seen it, and I'll be hosting an event this Wednesday night on the campus of Northeastern Illinois University that will screen this fascinating 28-minute thing called The Editor's Notebook, as well as a hour-long feature film called Power of the Press. I am honored to do it. Julian Antos of the Film Society is on the phone. Julian, I really am thrilled to do this.
Yeah, this is going to be fantastic, and we're so happy to have you presenting it.
Well, you were rambling about it, presenting it. It's a show. I cannot tell you how taken I was with the film, The Editor's Notebook. Can I ask you how, I may have done it before, but how did the Film Society get this piece? It was made in Chicago originally in 1950. How did you get it, and what did you have to do to bring it back to life?
Yeah, so this is something we found actually in a very unglamorous situation. It was in a sort of moldy basement of a film collector, along with a couple hundred other reels of miscellaneous Hollywood features, and these are all 35 millimeter prints, so reels about 16 inches in diameter and 35
sure.
millimeters wide. We started going through it all, this title popped out at us immediately. One, because of the Chicago connection, and two, because this was produced by a company called Wilding Pictures Productions that was actually started in Detroit by an old traveling salesman in 1914, and they were making what were called sponsored films. So they would make films for companies like Standard Oil and U.S. Steel and Chrysler and Sears, just about those companies. And so this production company moved to Chicago and New York and Cleveland and expanded. And we're actually based in Chicago out of the old S&A studios where Charlie Chaplin worked for a time.
Sure.
And they produced hundreds of films, and this was one of them.
One of the things that fascinates me about this film in particular, and we'll get to the other one, is that it had I don't know if this happened to all of the Wilding films. This had a theatrical release. It was released, it was shown at the Woods Theater for a time and then spread out to the many neighborhood theaters that were around in 1950. Was that, Julian Antos, was that common at the time for these kind of films?
It's actually pretty uncommon, especially for this production company. It's the only film we know of that was distributed on 35 millimeter as opposed to 16 millimeter, which would have been shown in like churches and prisons and schools and places like that. But this was actually, you know, showing in real movie theaters along with features as part of a theatrical program.
Yeah, I find it fascinating. What it says to me is that there were some editors at the Daily News who just muscled their advertising department or something to say, hey, make these theaters show our film. Wouldn't you think?
Yeah, yeah.
Wouldn't you think? So what was involved in saving this film?
So there's a wonderful organization called the National Film Preservation Foundation, and they provide grants to a lot of smaller organizations that have film collections and do film preservations, and they're really looking out for movies like this that don't necessarily still have a home or especially a copyright holder. You know, in the case of Wilding Studios, once that studio closed, there's pretty strong evidence that all the original elements were destroyed. So the print we worked from that we found, we supplemented some footage from a print at the Library of Congress. Our print was actually missing about the first 5 seconds or so, and the Library of Congress print was even more incomplete. So we took the first 5 seconds of the Library of Congress print and our print, and we sent both prints to a film lab in Los Angeles called Photochem.
Wow.
And they do a lot of archival work photochemically. So this is all the work that was done was on 35 millimeter and not done digitally. And so we had them take these two prints and create a new what's called a preservation negative. And we made our new prints from that, which is what we'll show on Wednesday.
I loved it. I'll be writing about it, ladies and gentlemen, for Tuesday's Chicago Tribune. It makes me terribly, terribly sad. I mean, it makes me wonderfully happy that Julian Antos and his colleagues at the Chicago Film Society have saved and resurrected this, because you can't even get digital. You can't get digital versions of the Daily News, which is one of the legendary papers in the country. You got to go through the microfilm somewhere. No one is even bothered. But you can imagine, Julian, how incredibly frustrating that is for me, because my father also worked at the Daily News.
Oh, absolutely.
Tell me about, I'm going to be, again, it's at 7:30. You can just go to ChicagoFilmSociety.org. You have a great website with so much information about each.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, I love it. So much information and research by you and your colleagues. And didn't you marry one of them?
As a matter of fact, I did.
Who did you marry and when? She was.
So that's Becca Hall, and we both worked at the predecessor to our organization, the Bank of America Cinema. and both, you know, or both in the movie business.
When did you get married? when did you get married?
October 5th of last year.
I knew it was recent. Tell me in about 2 minutes, whet the people's appetite. Again, it's Wednesday night, 7:30 at Northeastern Illinois University on West 3700 West Bryn Mawr, I think. Go to Chicago.
Take an extra 5 or 10 minutes to get there. It's worth it once you find it, but it's a university campus, so you do need to poke around for the right building.
Go to ChicagoFilmSociety.org. Give me a 2-minute take on this other film. It's only 1 hour and 4 minutes long. It's a feature film. It's called Power of the Press. And you know what I learned in my strange research today? That it's the second, it's not the same kind of movie, but there was another Power of the Press, a silent film directed by Frank Capra. You've made me into a movie nut, Julian Antos.
Excellent.
What is that?
Of course, as soon as the film comes in, we double-check the cans to make sure it's the 1943 version and not the 1928 version.
Tell me about this movie. I'm very excited to see it.
Yeah, this is going to be fantastic. You know, it's a B picture, so it would have played on the bottom of a double bill, and it's a lean 60-something minutes. The script is by Sam Fuller, the great director and newspaper man.
Mm-hmm.
And it stars two of my favorite actors, Lee Tracy and Guy Kibbe. Guy Kibbe is more of a character actor that has appeared in dozens and dozens of films. And Lee Tracy had a pretty popular career in the early 30s, and it's just a real fast talking sort of guy. So this will be a great film, and one that definitely doesn't screen too often.
Well, I would literally, I mean, just if I were, even if I weren't hosting, I would go to this event Wednesday night just to see The Editor's Notebook, just to see. It's kind of a documentary with dramatized portions. And the part about the photographer and the reporter, played by two actors, going to do an expose on Skid Row is not to be believed. I mean, I find it is a commercial for the Daily News. There's no question about it. But I find the movie exciting and charming, and I can't wait to see it again.
Yeah. We're excited to see you there.
I will be there. Yeah, trust me, I'll be there. And there'll be a story for those of you who read newspapers in Tuesday's art section in the Chicago Tribune. Again, go to ChicagoFilmSociety.org. It's a great site. You will lose yourself there after you've gotten the information you need about the Wednesday night extravaganza. Julian, congratulations on the wedding, and I will see you Wednesday night.
Thanks very much. See you Wednesday.
Thank you very, very much. Take care. We will take a break, and then we will have in here Chris Green to talk about you got a live CD. This is like a jazz evening peppered with visual arts and cinematic arts. We'll be right back. I love having you in.
I've had
you and the entire quintet in here, and sometimes, and it's very interesting. We were talking earlier with George Freeman, who, mm-hmm. of course, is the younger brother of the late Von Freeman, who have been, on some level, any saxophonist is going to be influenced by Von.
Absolutely. And, you know, you have to, it's almost a rite of passage. You have to go to his jam. You had to go to Von's jam session at the new apartment lounge, and I was fortunate to play with him a couple times, and when I was a youngster, he at least would know whatever I was trying to do at the time. He would, you know, he heard something and was like, "Hey, man, I hear what you're trying to do," which is almost a backhanded thing. What you're trying to do as opposed to what you're doing.
Well, they were. I mean, it was interesting that George was talking too about. He kept using that phrase "coming up."
Yeah.
And this person helped me when I was coming up, and he was telling stories about. I mean, you would have loved it. He's telling stories about Charlie Parker.
Oh yeah.
I mean, so he tells me next time you're at Jazz Showcase, where I know you played occasionally, beautiful blow up picture of Charlie Parker. he is wearing George Freeman's tie.
No kidding.
And he told this fascinating story about how Vaughn told him he shouldn't go on stage without a tie. And he goes, what am I going to do? And so they took the tie. It's a very funny story. But there is, it also goes to that. You have a great, great, Chris Green, appreciation of the history of jazz. I mean, you were influenced by
Absolutely.
Why? And you and your colleagues in the quintet, all of you have an appreciation for it.
The older I'm getting, the more I'm, you know, it's like one of those things, the more you know, the more you realize how much you don't know.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, like, I'll get on a binge of somebody I really like, you know, like, say, Sonny Rollins or whatever. Actually, no, even like, I just was going through some old vinyl, and I found this, like, you know, best of the tenor collection, you know, and had all the kind of old swing guys, Lester Young and Coleman Hawkins and Don Byas. But then there was this other guy named Julian Dash, who I'd never heard of. And he was like just kind of a regular old swing guy, like, you know, more on the R&B early 50s instrumental, kind of in that King Curtis kind of vein, you know, maybe a prior to King Curtis. But I'd never heard of this guy. And so now I've been checking out some of his stuff. And so it's just kind of like, wow, you know, I thought I knew a lot of stuff. And it turns out I need to, we're always constantly learning, you know.
But some people, that's an admirable way to feel. But I there are a number of people I know who are not constantly learning, who think they have hit. Yeah, not saying you're better than them, or it's a different, just a different way of artistically growing.
You know, I mean, not knocking the people that find the thing that really hits and they're able to, you know, make a career out of it. I know that attacking the history or learning as much about the history of the music, I only know it's going to make me better. You know, and I only know that it'll make me, as an individual musician, it'll make me more versatile, because I'll be able to play more older stuff and more modern stuff, and even just on as a band leader, I've got more stuff to draw upon. And then if I make some great artistic statement or whatever, I can say with authority, you know, like.
Well, I think this CD, and it amazes me. I mean, you and I have talked before, and virtually I'll put the arm on every musician who comes in here to talk to me about the chaotic stage of modern contemporary recording these days. This is a live CD, limited edition.
Yep.
Play Space, because it was taped live at Space.
Yes.
Talk to me about the leap to you and your three pals sitting around saying, I think we should make another CD. That obviously is the beginning of it. Why?
Well, here's the thing. Well, so we have these, in addition to the albums we've released, they have three kind of freebie giveaway albums called Playtime, which can named after one of my favorite movies, Playtime. So, and usually what we'll do, if you get like a good board, soundboard recording or something, I'll just kind of like throw it up on a SoundCloud or Bandcamp or whatever and just say, hey, people who followed us around for years, you know, here's something.
Of which there are an increasing number.
Yeah. So thank you very much for following us around. Here's a nice little simple live recording that you'll like, you know, that you can download for free. But, so we played Space last January, and it was a really great night. It was, if I recall correctly, and again, we weren't necessarily planning on making a recording. Space has the option, if you give them a few extra dollars, they'll give you a really nice digital recording of the night. And so we weren't really planning to record, and it actually ended up being a really great night attendance wise, like 100 and some people there.
Wow.
We were like up against the Grammys, and I thought, and it was the middle of January.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, okay, no one's going to be here.
So it's weather like the middle of April.
Exactly. Exactly. It's January and April. But, you know, it ended up being a really great night, and it ended up being like a really just, we were really together and really playing really well. And I just kind of, I was initially just going to, like, you know, throw it back, you know, hey, folks, here's another freebie. But I just kind of listened to it. I was like, you know what? This is really good. And I think people might pay for this one. So it was never really a plan to make a record until I kind of listen to it.
Listen to it. So, I mean, obviously, one of the advantages of doing something live, I was listening not long ago to Sarah Vaughan live at Mr. Kelly's, and I'm trying to imagine the differences in the technology involved of doing that. You must have had to have microphones all over the place.
A big tape machine or something in the room.
So the technology, that's one reason why it is easier to do a live piece.
Exactly. I mean, you know, they've got the means to, at this place. I mean, it's already pretty technologically sound. Space is great.
Space is such a nice place. Wonderful.
What great room, great intimate room. But what they offer, like I said, they offer just a you know, multi-track recording. And, you know, and you walk out with, you know, you bring them a little flash drive. You can put the whole show on the flash drive. And you walk out with the whole show. And so, like I said, I was listening to it. And I was like, this is really good. So we kind of did what we usually do. We gave the recordings to our guy, Joe Totorici, our producer. You know, he worked his magic on it. And, you know, we kind of wanted to do this particular CD with very little fanfare. Typically, when we put out a CD, it's like, you know, it's almost like the game, you know, everyone's talking about Game of Thrones. Like,
the premiere of Game of Thrones.
The premiere is coming.
Another Chris Green CD.
You know, I always make a big deal about it. Another CD is coming and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, get ready. You want to pre-order. This, I just kind of did the kind of surprise thing. Like,
I think it's very smart. You're going to be on all the way till 11. I want to listen. Have you give us a good, like, you know, not some of the cuts are quite long, but really a good sample. I think you people, the Chris Green Quartet, were just playing every Saturday, every Saturday now at Andy's. It's not like every Monday. This is every Saturday.
Yes, this month.
At Andy's, which is still among the great jazz clubs in this universe. Levin East Hubbard. How's that going?
It's good. It's good. We did Mondays last year.
I remember. I wrote about you guys.
That's right. Yes, you did.
January 30th.
Yes, you did. We were just about to start that.
2018. And it was a wonderful piece for me to write. Because I plumbed you guys and asked, because I found all of you guys are interesting. Why do you play? And just simply ask the question, why do you play jazz?
Right.
But you were doing Mondays in Andy's.
We're doing Mondays, and it's a different vibe. Like that was a great. The Mondays run was a great run, and the Saturdays are great. It's two different types of people. Monday people are kind of the in town conventioneers, looking for something to do, looking to go to a place where they, you know, either they're going to go to Buddy Guy's to see Chicago blues or Andy's to see Chicago jazz.
Right.
So the Saturday people are a little bit more like, maybe a little more savvier, like
sophisticated. Savvier is a
only in
word.
The sense of like what they'll do is they'll come in like for meal, and they're actually there to see music. And they're there. They'll go so far as to like. I looked to see who was playing, and I checked out all the info on you, and like they've done their homework, and it's really like.
See,
oh,
that's
thank
another
you.
Thing. So, I rail against most technological developments, but you know certainly the internet has enabled people to get. You know, if they want to go to a restaurant, they can see the food.
Right.
If they
right.
want to go see a jazz guy, they can hear the music.
Exactly.
I mean, it makes it easier. Chris Green's going to be here all the way till 11. You're going to hear some music. We're going to talk some more because I like talking to him because he's smart. Chris Green Jazz is the website. Chris Green with an E, actually with threes.
Yes.
But you guys are smart. ChrisGreenJazz.com. I promise you, play you a longer version of the Chris Green Quartet because it is, it's Damien Espinosa on piano, Mark Piani.
Mark Piani, right.
Piani, yeah, that's right, on double bass. And who's the last guy? Wait a minute, I wrote about Steve Corley.
Steve
Corley on drums. Last year, in January of 2018, I wrote about them. And they were you can look it up easily. Just look up Rick Hogan and Chris Green Quartet, and you'll find the story. We're talking about this new live album that was taped taped. Not taped.
Yeah,
I
say,
don't know.
You can still say taped.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you can still say taped.
Thank you. In my expertise in this new electronic world, you can get the album as a download. You can get it as it's a bit really it's handsomely packaged
yes,
too.
Yes,
that's another thing. All of your stuff, all of your CDs, even though you do just send out a song every once in a while to your fans, you like to have them in those packages, don't you? Why, Chris?
You know, I'm old school. I know it's. So, I mean, I think we can agree.
Sure.
It's like I grew up with albums. You grew up with albums.
Yep.
You know, a cohesive artistic statement. You know, a collection of songs that you were about whatever was going on in your life or whatever at the time that encapsulates that moment.
Well, and they're also they are. And I'm rail about this all the time that they are. They're not just, you don't toss up 10 tunes and just, well, this one landed here and this
right.
one. There's a narrative to each of your CDs.
There's always something. It's a pun, if you will, like Music Appreciation or, you know, Boundary Issues was the last one, Play Space. Kind of an amalgam of the Playtime freebie stuff that I was going to do, and then Space, you know, the place that we recorded it. So I just kind of like mashed them together. And even the cover. A real super talented guy, a fan of ours, a guy by the name of Kerry Cochran, a graphic artist, he does all kinds of art. He lives in Winnetka, and he's come out to our shows several times, and he'll doodle and just do something on a napkin and then, you know, send it to me or give it to me after the gig. And so afterwards, one gig in particular, he drew the picture, thing that ends up being on the cover, like, you know, he was just screwing around, and then, you know, next morning he emails me this cover, and I'm like, dude, I hope you don't mind. That's going to be our next album cover. It's like, sure. Like,
he said, I'm flattered.
And he's like, how much? I was like, how much do you want? He's like, just buy me a drink or something next time you see me. And I was like,
well, that's maybe the best deal you'll make in a long time.
You know,
what do the other three guys think of the? Obviously, you like this live CD, and I think a live CD is just such a rarity these days. What do the other boys think?
They dug it. I think the decision to make it like an official release was kind of like a surprise. But I mean, they're used to, you know, thought out melodic, methodical Chris Green, and then they also know that the impulsive decision will come.
That's
what we're doing. Okay,
you guys are, and I discovered this when I talked to all of you at length about your music and your backgrounds. You're a wonderfully collaborative quartet. I mean, you listen to each other, you respect each other, you bring different elements into it. Expand on that for me.
It's just, well, you know, I'm not on stage alone, for one thing, and it helps me be a better band leader. Here's the thing, I just heard, of all people, I heard this recent quote from like Tarantino, Quentin Tarantino, who was talking about he was talking to Terry Gilliam, I think, about, like, you know, how do you, you know, he's asking
some
him,
conversation.
Yeah, they were talking at some film festival, and I think Quentin was like brand new, and he was like, how do you get your, you know, asking Terry Gilliam, how do you get your vision on screen? Like, how do you, you know, you clearly you have a vision. How does it go from your idea, it's in your head, to there? And I guess Gilliam's response was, you don't have to know how to, like, do costumes. You don't have to know how to do cinematography. You don't have to know how to move the camera. All you need to know is how to explain what you want to do.
Interesting.
And hire talented people to do it.
Yeah, interesting.
And that's pretty much like I've worked with three of the best musicians in the city of Chicago, and they're creative in their own right, but they also see the big picture about, like, what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I talk about this all the time. Like, I can write tunes, but sometimes I can't figure out an ending. Mark is really good about helping me with end songs, or you know.
Now, you guys have been together since about 2005. That's a good long time for a group who does not play, you know, 5 days a week together.
Yeah.
And how do you, you've got a great thing going on. Again, it's Chris Green Jazz, Green with an E at the end of it, meaning three E's in Green. ChrisGreenJazz.com. Saturday's at Andy's this month.
Yep.
And what are your ambitions for this group?
Ooh, that's a good one.
Because you are building. I mean, I hear about you all, especially since I wrote that piece. People are saying, where are they playing? I saw that band you wrote about, and which is a very good thing.
Thank you. Thank you.
First of all, it tells people reading newspapers.
They're
reading newspapers and going to see jazz.
And buying albums, buying whole albums,
yeah,
too.
That's right. Yeah.
What are the ambitions? You know, really more... Just building an audience. I detest the term brand.
Me too.
I detest that term immensely. But there is
we live in that age
where you have to think brand.
Before we take a break, let's pick a song and we'll hear a good 3 minutes of it. I think that'll give people
sure absolutely.
It's your call. Dan Long is operating the board.
Maybe was it number four? Crossover Appeal, maybe? Is that the one? Hopefully I got that right.
That's five.
Did I say five? Oops.
You don't need to know numbers.
Don't even know my own. I put together the album. I don't even know it. Jeez.
Crossover Appeal. Let's hear a few minutes of that. Welcome back. I have a few more minutes, never enough, with Chris Green. You can go to his website after you've listened to the Carl Amari show, which comes on after this. And Chris's website is Chris Green, G-R-E-E-N-E, jazz.com. He and my three other pals of the quartet play every Saturday night in Andy's. How many sets do you do?
Two 90-minute sets.
You must have been, we talked a little about Andy's before, you had a Monday residence mm-hmm. there earlier in the year, in 2018. And when the owners of Andy's come and say, hey, you want to do Saturday nights? You must have, it sounds like, but it may not be. It sounds like, wow, you're graduating to the big time at Andy's. Mm-hmm. But you talked about the differences in the kind of crowds.
Yeah, no, it's a different crowd. The Mondays crowd, I think they're just looking for something to do in Chicago, whereas the Saturday crowd know exactly what they're going to see.
That's an interesting point, yeah.
But, yeah, no, it's definitely a graduation of sorts, just because you're, and we, you know, we had the 9-month residency of Mondays, so now we're just doing like a month or so of like Saturdays. But I like it.
You four guys are so smart and intuitive. Do you change the ways in which you play or the things you play based on a crowd ever?
Good question. Kind of sort. We rarely, like I think, like I said in the article, like we never write a set list,
right?
But we try to go with like the vibe of the crowd. Like if say like we played like last year we played a concert at a library in Arlington Heights, mm-hmm. and we knew that we couldn't necessarily, we only had an hour, and so we couldn't really hit them over the head with like our really crazy stuff.
Yeah,
but the stuff that had a little more of a groove, like that we could get some heads nodding and some feet tapping, mm-hmm. we kind of hit them with a lot of that stuff. And we kind of step out of the box with like a crazy time signature, like here and there. But we don't necessarily change what we do, but we've got enough diverse stuff in our repertoire that like if we could play, like we've played like, say a retirement home where people are expecting like this kind of stuff, yeah. like really like 1930s, 40s swing. And so we can pull stuff that they would like, and then we could pull, you know, like at Space where we can do whatever the heck we want.
Yeah.
We can just kind of go all over the place. So
it's a wonderful thing that your two, you know, main homes here are Space and Andy's.
Yeah.
I mean, it just literally, I mean, I love the Showcase too, and I love, you know, I love the Acorn Theater
right.
up in, if you're listening, David Fink, I love the Acorn Theater and you in Three Oaks, Michigan. You got a good life. I mean, you know, you're $10 million in the bank, but Chris
right.
Green, you were,
I'm doing okay.
You know, that's one of the things, and we talked about it in that article too, and I talk about it with most artists, that there are great sacrifices one makes with, you know, you don't have an IRA, you don't have a pension thing, but it's the passion that drives you.
Exactly.
And the rewards are different.
Yeah.
They may not show up in a bank account, but they show up in some kind of soul account.
Exactly. You know, and, you know, money comes and goes. You know, I eat every day. My son has clothes on his back.
Yeah.
You know.
His son's cute. Dude.
Yeah. He's you know, he's growing up, and, you know, so, and I've got a hugely supportive, you know, wife and
yeah.
family and everything
yeah.
else. So, you know, it's good. All those little things help me to kind of cobble out my little,
well,
my little
more,
existence.
It's so. More than cobbling. Let's, before you leave, let's listen to about 4 minutes of another song, because I think this really does give the listeners a taste, and much more so than, you know, the 30-second bump in
yeah, thank
or
you.
Something. What would you like to hear?
I think, what did we say? Was it the last one? Number two, Thundersnow. Perfect one. Yeah, this is something that Damien wrote, and this is, this is one of our all-over-the-place kind of songs.
Right. Thank you. Chris Green, I love this. That's Chris Green on sax, Damien Espinosa on piano, Mark Piani on bass, and Steve Corley on drums.
Yep.
That is the Chris Green Quartet. Every Monday, they used to play every Monday at Andy's. Now they are every Saturday at Andy's. Mm-hmm. Are you doing any traveling?
Doing some traveling, doing some stuff in Detroit, Michigan, and South Bend, Indiana, and then a couple things. We're supposed to go out west this fall.
Neat. How do you find when you do travel? I mean, the jazz scene in Chicago is, I would hazard to say, relatively healthy.
Yeah.
It's not as explosive as it was, you know, 20, 30 years ago. Just aren't many venues, but I think the crowds are good.
Yeah.
And appreciative. How do you find it around the country when you do travel?
I think Chicago surprisingly has, you know, we've got a fair amount of a decent reputation. I mean, yeah. And we've had a fair amount of
talent.
People, you know, talent yeah. come out of there and, you know, go off to New York or California or whatever. So our reputation precedes us in a lot of ways. But also just, I mean, I think people like music. People like good music. And yeah. I think a lot of that just, you know, the goodwill that we've built up over the past few years is starting to carry to other places, and people are starting to reach out to what we do. And,
one of the things, you know, Chris, just because you're such a thoughtful guy, talk to me for a couple of minutes. We've got about 4 minutes left.
Okay.
But talk to me about the value of live performance. I mean, I think the world is getting, we don't communicate in the same ways, and we tweet mm-hmm. instead of talk, and we get sort of removed from that whole
right.
thing. And I think, you know, I know a lot of kids, you know, who have never, like, just seen a movie in a movie theater.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's like, why would I? And they're like, why would I do that? I can get it on my TV. I can get it on my phone.
Right,
I'm
right.
Like, well, there's a different experience. Talk to me about that for a second.
You know, it's funny you should mention that. Like, a couple of years ago, I got a chance to see Branford Marsalis play some classical music with the CSO.
Yeah.
And, you know, you kind of... Stupid me taking something as great as the CSO for granted, but you know I hadn't really been to there in, you know, it's been about 10 years since I'd been to see something there, and you know you're used to hearing classical music everywhere in like a department store or whatever.
Sure,
but to see that, you know, to have that live,
mm-hmm.
the biggest string section in the world just wash over you is just like whoa, you know, and even just, you know, and then not to. Quote, you know, not to pat ourselves on the back, but I forget that we as musicians have, you know, we have that power. People come to see live music, you know, to, you know, forget their troubles or just yep. have a good time or, yep. or, you know, fill up a day or whatever, fill up a night. But, you know, and I forget that we, when we're on stage, not just CGQ, but we musicians in general have that power, you know, that to uplift people and stuff.
What you see on stage is the human interaction between it.
Right.
It is music.
Yes.
And that's the main thing. But you're seeing people look at each other in different ways and
absolutely.
Move. And it's like there's a sort of spontaneous choreography that happens to a lot of it, too.
There is. And even though, like, our typical music goer or club goer doesn't necessarily know about the intricacies of what's going on or who my influences are or
sure.
whatever, they still know how they feel afterwards or they know how you made them feel or they know, you know, something's going on with their brain and
that's
heart.
That's the thing, man. Something is going on.
You know,
on.
And they know.
Chris
and
Green, it is always a pleasure. Pleasure to see you and talk to you, too. Chris Green is part of the Chris Green Quartet with Damien Espinosa on piano, Mark Piani on bass, and Steve Corley on drums. You can see them every Saturday night at Andy's, which remains one of the great jazz clubs in the world, 11 East Hubbard. And the new CD is out, but just go to Chris Green, your internet people, go to Chris Green with an ejazz.com. Chris, always good to
Thank
see you.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate
always
that.
Good to
Thank
see you.
You.